So I thought instead of trying to synthesize and integrate what we've covered so far with Sri Aurobindo's point of view, it would be better to first do as we have done with the other two texts and just present Sri Aurobindo's point of view. Because we're gathering tools. Our approach has been in pursuing the psychology of social development to explore the ideas of those who have concentrated their genius on formulating this kind of understanding. And in a way, it seems to me at least that spiral dynamics and Gebser's work, The Ever-Present Origin, are very thorough, systematic attempts to outline a psychology of social development and a psychology of consciousness, the development of consciousness, in terms of the human cycle. So Sri Aurobindo's book, The Human Cycle, was originally titled The Psychology of Social Development. And as I said in the very beginning of this series, it's a quite extraordinary work. When I look at it in the context of all of Sri Aurobindo's work, I still find it extraordinary. So this week I spent some time going through it again, and last night I quickly put together 24 slides. Not in a very systematic way, but with the intention of presenting Sri Aurobindo's view of the human cycle, his system. And then it's up to us to integrate this system, with this system, the others that we have explored. And ultimately, the integrator is the self. If we can really incorporate these tools and use them in our lives for understanding our situation, then we have achieved something more than just a survey of the outlook of a few people. What I find extraordinary about this work is that it strikes me as being very intense, a very intense effort, and it's by Sri Aurobindo to express a point of view. It's not systematic, it's not easy to analyze or formulate. And as is characteristic of Sri Aurobindo's writing, each chapter is another window on the same thing. It's like each month when he sat down to write this particular work, he was looking at exactly the same thing and just expressing it with a slightly different dynamic. It is a subjective work. Sri Aurobindo is speaking about the coming of the subjective age, but in a subjective age in his particular view of what that means. Which is an age in which consciousness perceives itself in all. It's not rational. It's not the subjectivity of Kant and Hegel and generally modern psychology and science. It's not that green mean subjectivity. And it's not even the transpersonal as far as we've explored it a little bit. It's another kind of subjectivity. It's the supramental subjectivity. And the psychologists that we've looked at, the psychologies of development that we've looked at, have recognized the end of the rational and an intermediate transpersonal emergence of consciousness. But it appears to me that nobody has yet explored very thoroughly what this higher level of consciousness really is and really means in terms of social development. The so-called integral consciousness is something that from the bottom we can see as a possibility, and we can begin to experience. And so Gebser can speak about the emergence of the integral in a way which is very intuitive. And to the extent that it intersects with Sri Aurobindo and the mother, you can feel that he is resonating with something that we're somehow familiar with. And he knows that he's resonating with that. But it's not yet a realization. He's speaking of it as a coming possibility, which, if this mutation is experienced, will have certain features that are different from the rational. But he continues to observe the memes of the different stages of society and to base his analysis on those products, which is a rational point of view. He is analyzing and understanding the development of human society on the basis of its memes. But Sri Aurobindo is not doing that. He's not referring very much to anything concrete. He is expressing in his unique style, chapter after chapter, a certain subjective understanding of the human cycle. So his interpretation, his system, fundamentally identifies planes of being, planes of existence, each of which is characterized by a consciousness. Consciousness perceives planes of existence. Consciousness creates planes of existence. Consciousness is planes of existence. Consciousness develops through structures of the human being and periods of time of the human civilization. And so we can understand Gebser pretty well in terms of this system. So I want to just go through some slides which are taken directly from the human cycle, texts that are taken from the human cycle, which should impart to us, in the Gebserian sense, we should experience an impartation of a kind of verition which is diaphanous. If in fact the integral consciousness is expressing itself here through these statements. So this is an experiment in a way, and in a way it's just a survey of Sri Aurobindo's system. Beginning with what we could amalgamate into a plane known as the vital physical. Our normal conduct of life, whether the individual or the social, is actually governed by the balance between two complementary powers. First, an implicit will, central to the life and inherent in the main power of its action. And secondly, whatever modifying will can come in from the idea in mind. A vital will in life and a mental will in mind. These two powers create in their balance or imbalance what we know as life. For man is a mental being, and these two operate through our as yet imperfect mental instruments to give this life force a conscious orientation and a conscious method. Wait just a moment. Life. So this is the plane of existence that Sri Aurobindo is addressing in this section. Life normally finds its own center in our vital and physical being. We never experience the physical separate from the vital or the mental. It is a threefold complex, always, since life emerged on earth. Life normally finds its own center in our vital and physical being, in its cravings and its needs, in its demand for persistence, growth, expansion, enjoyment, in its reachings after all kinds of power and possession and activity and splendor and largeness. The first self-direction of this life force, its first orderings of method, are instinctive and either entirely or very largely subconscient and magnificently automatic. The ease, spontaneity, fine normality, beauty, self-satisfaction, abundant vital energy and power of the subhuman life of nature, up to the animal, is due to its entire obedience to this instinctive and automatic urge. This is probably a description that we can associate with what we normally think of as the physical world. Although the physical world moved by the life force. It's very almost impossible for us to think of the quantum world and molecules apart from their function in cells and so on. So the material world per se is the world that Sri Aurobindo most often refers to as the inconscient, into which life as a principle comes at some point and begins to organize according to a method. And that method is not conscious, but that doesn't make it any less methodical. Life force is a consciousness that organizes the material world for the purpose of persistence, growth, expansion, evolution, enjoyment. It is the will to live. Yeah. You want to bring in something?
The interesting point is here that you can see, I would identify this in Gipsari in terms of the magic structure, by the way, because this is that life force which is organizing life where man is not yet there, conscious of himself. But the previous slide was saying something about the willpower, which is expressing itself in the life realm and then in the mind realm, the same willpower. Expresses itself differently in two different ways.
And that absolutely is the point of the coming slides. That gets well differentiated.
Right. What I wanted to say, this is a Vedic vision.
Could you go back that you can't
follow this thing? It is simply, it is a Vedic vision because the fire, the Agni, who is growing within, first builds up that realm in the inconscient, which we know as life realm. That impulsion of the divine within, that inconscient creates that what is known to us as life. And then, when in evolutionary process it grows up and expresses itself as a mental being, it becomes a different force. But the same way, on a different level, becomes something else. In this case, it is, in this sense, it is quite different from Gibson. There is one driving force for all the structures. Maybe I anticipated something.
You anticipated everything. But this is bound to happen if you have read both Gebser and Sri Aurobindo in depth. Then you can easily anticipate everything. So we are representing these points of view, these understandings.
With this one and the next one, where then is this, it's a mental being?
It's about five slides down the order.
Okay. Sorry.
Because we're going to build the whole complex. Okay, I made an order of the slides, and I don't have time to reorder it because it might be nicer.
Oh,
sure. And if you write down the number and you want to go back later, you can ask me to go back to the slide. We have seen that there are necessarily three stages of the social evolution. Social evolution. Or, generally, of the human evolution in both individual and society. Our evolution starts with an infra-rational stage in which men have not yet learned to refer their life and action in its principles and its forms to the judgment of the clarified intelligence. So, the human being behaves infra-rationally in the Gebserian sense, as if the human being were a point in which everything is contained, and the behavior is not self-reflecting, it is not objectifying. It is primordial, but it's conscious and methodical because it is life in the human being that is conscious. It is conscious at that level of emergence which is identified as the archaic or the magical. For they still act principally out of their instincts, impulses, spontaneous ideas, vital intuitions, or obey a customary response to desire, need, and circumstance. It is these things, vital intuitions, desires, needs, and circumstances, that are canalized or crystallized in their social institutions. Man proceeds by various stages which we have been examining. Out of these beginnings, towards a rational age in which his intelligent will, more or less developed, becomes the judge, arbiter, and presiding motive of his thought, feeling, and action. The molder, destroyer, and recreator of his leading ideas, aims, and intuitions. So in the magical and mythical emergence stages of or structurations of civilization, the rational is emerging, but it is not dominant. So all of those memes that are produced by the magical and the mythical are pre-rational structures. They are not self-conscious as such. Finally, if our analysis and forecast are correct, this is an amazing statement by Sri Aurobindo, and it occurs several times in this text. And it's like every time he goes back to revision this understanding of existence, he entertains the possibility that it's not correct.
Excuse me.
not that he doubts it. I don't believe that he doubts it for a minute. But he feels it very, clearly a very urgent need to question it. Because he is proposing this. And it's essential. And it hasn't emerged. And it's the whole point of his effort to awaken this next will. Finally, if our analysis and forecast are correct, the human evolution must move through a subjective towards a suprarational or spiritual age, in which he will develop progressively a greater spiritual, supra-intellectual, and intuitive, perhaps in the end, a more than intuitive, a Gnostic consciousness.
Basically, this is his tribute to the rational structure, what he does.
This is only the beginning of his tribute.
I mean, this reference that if these are correct.
Yeah, but wait till you see his full tribute to the rational structure, because that's what's coming now. And in this book, Sri Aurobindo's tribute to the rational structure is enormous. It's powerful. He wants us to understand fully the extraordinary importance and power of the rational structure in order for this next one to come. But it's very mixed, as is our development in each of these worlds. And so here he recognizes that very explicitly. As with the psychological life of individuals, so must it be with the ages of his communal existence. These ages, so well defined by Gebser, may be marked off from each other by the predominant play of one element. Its force may overpower the others, or take them into itself, or make some compromise. But an exclusive play seems to be neither intended nor possible. So there is never just a mythic civilization or just a magical civilization, and there is never a human being who is just rational or just vitalistic or just magical. The occultist in the magical age is driven by vitalistic and rationalistic motives. The mystic and the creator of religions may be predominantly mythical in the motive, but the vital and the rational and the suprarational are all playing there. And what Sri Aurobindo goes to great lengths to describe is how at any level when there is the emergence of some new predominant principle, it is constantly being attacked and drugged down by the previous predominant principle. And it takes a long, it's an age, because many civilizations may rise and fall in order for the dominant principle to really emerge as a dominant principle. Just as in our lives, there may be many cycles in yoga where different levels emerge and are then submerged and then re-emerge until we establish in ourselves a firm principle of or method of organizing life. Sri Aurobindo is not dwelling upon any of these dynamisms in detail with respect to the others. He merely points out that each emerges in the context of the others, and to become dominant is the process of developing a civilization and perhaps having it fall because the new principle is not sufficiently well developed.
But there is this natural hierarchy or natural line of
development? There is a progression. He observes that there is, throughout the history of the human being, a progression. And so if there's a relapse, then it restarts at the lower level and builds back up to the higher level. We may not realize the element of reason in a primitive theory of life or of spirituality in a barbaric religion, because it appears to us to be made up of symbols and forms to which a superstitious value is attached by these undeveloped minds. But this is because the reason at this stage has an imperfect and limited action, and the element of spirituality is crude or undeveloped and not yet self-conscious. It doesn't mean it's not playing its role in the evolution of consciousness in a most important manner, and it doesn't mean that rationality isn't there, hidden in it, but it isn't yet self-conscious in the way that we would recognize if reason was its dominant characteristic.
This is a
universal assumption in developmental psychology, that the previous stage is necessary for the emergence of the next stage. Each is involved from the beginning.
Almost entirely.
Yeah.
You're saying in sequence. You don't have to do that.
Yes. No. Maybe. I mean, yes, the pattern is sequential. But whether in the emergence of a society it's necessary for it to go through all the stages is questionable. Wilbur says that if you're born in America today, you're going to be a rationalistic individual, regardless of how dominant the vital is in you or the magical tendency is that you have, or how well your magical tendency connects with your supra-rational intuition. You are fundamentally going to be a rational individual because you are a part of that life world, and you don't need to go back through everything in order to get to be rational. Whereas if you're born in a village in Africa, then the chances of you connecting with the your magical impulse with your supra-rational intuition may happen in a few individuals, but as a general principle in society, it's unlikely.
I thought Wilbur, in one of his recent books, that 70% of people, I don't know if he's talking about Americans or globally, are pre-rational.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It's
true.
Well, I mean, that would be, if that statement were actually being made, I would say it's highly questionable.
He would have to explain that.
Well,
from where, which place?
Do you have a comment to make?
Yeah, I was just to clarify, I think that's what Wilbur is saying, but at the same time, I think he also recognizes, like us, that each individual has to go from the embryonic stage and developing as a child and so on, through those stages of development that resemble the larger structures of a collective. So you can't escape that.
Right.
You still develop as an individual having to go through archaic, magical, and so on.
And this is
the society actually as a whole supports that up to the level of the rational,
yeah,
I would say. Whereas in a tribal society, you might not necessarily do that.
Absolutely. And this is the idea of Erickson and Piaget and all of the developmental psychologists, is exactly this idea that everyone recapitulates to some extent the different stages of development. And society is supposed to facilitate that process.
And we might be, in a sense, not completely going through that stage of the development of the archaic and the magical, because the social structure doesn't support it. So on an individual level, we do go through it, but it doesn't mean that we've fully gone through it.
Mm-hmm.
That's assuming that we're all individuals. But what about the collective part of me that needs to have that experience? Where does it go? And I think that might be a valid question to look at.
It might be, but we might not need to go through every stage also.
But you saw some of that, I mean, just to finish that, some of that in the whole New Age movement in the West, where people try to sort of like reconnect with their bodies and with nature and with their tribal urges and instincts and man's movement and all of that, sort of like just trying to recapture something that they felt lost.
Yeah, there's a very elaborate paragraph devoted to that question in this book. This tendency to want to go back and reestablish that. Okay, let's just move forward here with the broad outlines. The infrarational stage of society may arrive at a very lofty order of civilization. It may have great intuitions of the meaning or general intention of life, admirable ideas of the arrangement of life, a harmonious, well-adapted, durable, and serviceable social system, an imposing religion which will not be without its profundities, but in which symbol and ceremonial will form the largest portion, and for the mass of men will be almost the whole of religion. In this stage, pure reason and pure spirituality will not govern the society or move large bodies of men, but will be represented, if at all, by individuals, at first few, but growing in number, as these two powers increase in their purity and vigor, and attract more and more votaries. So he's referring here to Athens and to Amarna. The great civilizations which are led by a few intellects or visionaries or lawmakers, lawgivers, priesthoods that receive an inspiration from a few, but the mass in general is not on that level of consciousness and understanding. So Aristotle taught Alexander, but what good did that do? Now, this is a rather dense paragraph, and I put it here because it summarizes many of the things that have gone before. It's the end, it's the transition between life and mind. So, I'm going to read through it slowly, and the details are not so significant, but the pattern that's being described is comprehensive. Life. Life is, for Sri Aurobindo, a plane of existence and a being of consciousness. Life organizes itself, at first, round the ego motive and the instinct of ego expansion is the earliest means by which men have come into contact with each other. The struggle for possession has been the first crude means towards union. The aggressive assertion of the smaller self, the first step towards a growth into the larger self. All has been, therefore, a half-ordered confusion of the struggle for life, corrected by the need and instinct of association, a struggle of individuals, clans, tribes, parties, nations, ideas, civilizations, cultures, ideals, religions, each affirming itself, each compelled into contact, association, strife with the others. For while nature imposes the ego as a veil, behind which she labors out the individual manifestation of the spirit, she also puts a compulsion on it to grow in being until it can at last expand or merge into a larger self in which it meets, harmonizes with itself, comprehends in its own consciousness, becomes one with the rest of existence. To assist in this growth, life nature throws up in itself ego enlarging, ego exceeding, even ego destroying instincts and movements which combat and correct the smaller self-affirming instincts and movements. Life has in it an ethical impulse. she enforces on her human instrument impulses of love, sympathy, self-denial, self-effacement, self-sacrifice, altruism, the drive towards universality in mind and heart and life, glimmerings of an obscure unanimism that has not yet found thoroughly its own true light and motive power. So it's like this consciousness of unity is submerged in the life world, driving it towards its discovery. So even at the instinctual, magical level, even at the mythical level, there is a strong urge towards unity, which works through opposition, but which is not self-conscious. So this ends the section on the vital physical development of the human being and human society. So in Sri Aurobindo's vision, what Husserl called the life world, that which gets to be known by the rational mind, is a stage of development, a principle of existence, and a plane of consciousness. Which has produced many civilizations. Now, from the vital physical to the mental vital, because they're always overlapping, as we just saw in that description of the vital. We saw involved in it all the way through the mental. Now we're going to see the mental emerging as the dominant force, with the vital in it. The ideal and practical reason of man labors to find amidst all this, which we just read, the right law of life and action. Right law. This is reason. These are the memes of the reasoning mind. It strives by a rule of moderation and accommodation, by selection and rejection, or by the dominance of some chosen ideas or powers, to reduce things to harmony, to do consciously what nature, through natural selection and instinct, has achieved in her animal kinds. Today, evolutionary biologists are saying exactly this, that natural selection worked very well up to the emergence of mental consciousness, and from that point on it has taken over, and it has imposed upon itself all of these self-regulating patterns, and has selected those which it likes best, or doesn't like, or whatever. So the principle of natural selection is now working through the principle of conscious selection. It has emerged at another level of its method. But the order, the structure arrived at by the reason is always partial, precarious, and temporary. Because the life force is dynamic and it's continually agitating though within and beneath those right laws and ideal structures. It is disturbed by a pull from below and a pull from above. The ideal and practical reason is constantly disturbed by a pull from below and a pull from above.
It is then the nature's push from above and the disturbance?
Yes, everything is nature.
But it's a mental nature and what you refer to.
Yeah, let's see what he says. For these powers that life throws up to help towards the growth into a larger self, a wider being, are already reflections of something that is beyond reason, seeds of the spiritual, the absolute.
Are those the things you articulated in the previous slide?
No, he hasn't really articulated these pulls from above yet. Sympathy seems to be the movement of life towards its own organization. What's pulling from above is something else. We haven't seen that yet.
So in life itself, there is those seeds of compassion. They are there. In life
it's part of life.
Yeah.
It's part of ego. Yes. Life is divine. Life is a stage of the emergence of the divine, and it is possessed of feelings and judgments. Ego expansion for the sake of unity may entail ego repression and even ego destruction.
And then you mentioned Wilder, I'm not saying that that's what you believe, but Wilder said he believes that most of Western society, just by being born in modernity, post-modernity, you end up being a rational being. So in a sense, I equate that with being able to transcend or at least moderate the excesses of the ego. Good. So, but if I look at the present situation in the world, the environment, and the excessive materialism, consumerism, that play of what role is the ego actually still playing in that assumed more rational societal structure, and then you come back to what somebody said about Wilber's saying that actually 70% still lives in pre-rational. So I'm trying to sort of like mesh those.
Right. So I think one.
Are we sitting on that?
One question is whether the question is to what extent the ego is still dominant, or to what extent the vital is still dominant. There is the vital ego and there is the rational ego. Just because the society is predominantly rational, it doesn't mean that the vital ego is not is dominant. I mean, virtually the driving force there, which the rational is using, the rational ego is trying to use that vital force, and that vital force is trying to use that rational ego. And so there's no implication that just because the rational has emerged, that the vital is not still completely present in each ego.
Of course, the question then come like, how do you define when you the word dominance of the mental societal structure? You assume that therefore it has some power over the vital in constructive ways.
Yeah.
And otherwise, I have to rephrase the word dominance. How does it
make
the word emergence?
Right. Well, terms like dominance have to be relative. Right.
Yeah.
So.
Can I ask a clarification? 2 slides ago, when it was talking about ego, and then underneath ego, that symbol there, that list. Was that referring to the 2 different aspects of will and the way they could play out?
Was what? I mean, what was what referring to that?
Can you go back to, yes, down at the bottom, to assist this growth, life, nature throws up in itself ego enlarging, ego exceeding, even ego destroying instincts.
Which combat and correct the smaller self-affirming instincts and movements. So some egos become more interested in the welfare of the whole than in their own welfare, because they understand that that's in fact better for them also. But in order to do that, you have to resist the impulse to take more than you deserve.
So she enforces on her human instrument impulses of love, sympathy, and whatnot.
Which are egoistic.
It seems to me that that leads directly into the development of law. The attempt to make right.
It does.
Inspired from these.
Absolutely things. Does. So then, when these efforts to harmonize and organize become dominant, then there is the emergence of the rational, and it's not just instinctual at that point. So there are many formations in society that attempt different kinds of organization that are not particularly self-conscious. They may be quite, from our point of view, unsophisticated and crude. But still, they're there. The tribe and the clan are trying to organize themselves for the welfare of the group. They may be chopping off the heads of the neighbors at the same time. And then at some point, they may understand that it's better for them to get along with the neighbors. So it's still not a matter of law. But at some point, the society is complex enough that these things are regulated. These relationships over land and water and distribution of goods are regulated by law. People are still egoistic, but they are more constrained by the general acceptance of rules and regulations.
But even law, not informed by something beyond, can become more driven by this other ego, the exceeding, the attempt to overtake.
It's evolving.
I was thinking of what you said about the seeds placed in consciousness from above. And
I think what we want to try to do is understand that everything is here below, except the Absolute. Because the Absolute can't be here below. The Absolute is only the Absolute of everything. It cannot have any temporal expression. So the Absolute is a force that wants to bring out in evolving existence expressions of itself. And at this stage of the emergence of reason, it is life force developing through its ego formations ideas of the good. Now, those ideas of the good are resonating with a kind of absolute good, but that absolute good cannot really get very far with this dense vital society, and so that vital society is pulling down always all of our good ideas and turning them into means of production and mundane organization, practical organization, but still the absolute is now something that becomes somewhat visible to the emerging rational ego. The big question is whether that, well, let's see what the big question is. Reason, right now, we're just there. And you will be surprised to learn that reason, using the intelligent will, buddhi, for the ordering of the inner and the outer life, is undoubtedly the highest developed faculty of man at his present point of evolution. It is the sovereign. Doesn't mean it doesn't have rebellious subjects. Because the governing and self-governing faculty in the complexities of our human existence. It is the sovereign because, bracket, it is. The governing and self-governing faculty in the complexities of our human existence. Man is distinguished from other terrestrial creatures by his capacity for seeking after a rule of life, a rule of his being and his works, a principle of order and self-development, which is not the first instinctive, original, mechanically self-operative rule of his natural existence. Even when you decide whether to buy that dosa or that Life magazine, you are making reason is working in you so that your existence will be harmonious. And it's working consciously. Every moment, everything that we do is driven primarily by our reason, even if it's not conscious in us. There are other impulses, no doubt, but that one is the one that is working in us with considerable dominance.
Would you also say on a specific part of our identity. Is it more from what happens in the subliminal part of oneself? Is that also rationally driven? Or?
To a large extent, rationally controlled. In most people. No, I would say in most. Because even when the examples that are given in economic psychology today, you know, examples like having to do with whether if you're the male pushing the baby carriage and the wife is working in the law firm, and you come to the traffic light and you need to get to the park in time to have your illicit liaison. In all of these movements, the rational mind is operating to judge about the speed at which you cross the street with the child in the carriage and how much time you spend with your illicit liaison before you report back home for the, you know, and so these drives are there, subliminal drives are there, but they're all subject to a constant calculating process that's going on. It's a product of evolution. The life world has produced this reasoning being, and the principle of order, he said just before about the purpose of reason is to establish a principle of order. Now, what principle? The principle the reasoning human looks to is neither the unchanging, unprogressive order of the fixed natural type species, nor in its process of change the mechanical evolution we see in the lower life, an evolution which operates in the mass rather than in the individual, imperceptibly to the knowledge of that which is being evolved and without its conscious operation. We're not just, the reason is not just trying to make it work, to maintain something. The principle that it wants to realize is self-conscious deliberation, objectification of the process that is chosen, and the relative evaluation of that process to others. Comparative choice, conscious choice, is preferred by the reason over just maintaining an established order. And when it changes, it doesn't change because of the pressure of the environment necessarily. It changes because of what it chooses to be the best alternative, even if it's wrong. He seeks for an intelligent rule of which he himself shall be the governor and master, or at least a partially free administrator. If it's my choice, by God, it's right. No matter what you think. Just because I'm choosing it. And I'm basing my choice on my life experience and on my training and on my certificate in graduate school and all the many different mistakes I've made. So it's my choice and I'm making it consciously. And this is given a lot of importance by the human being, ultimate importance.
Situation of women, you know, here in Pakistan, they kept in the houses, they this restriction and not to allow them to live their free will and to do this process here. I think it's on the whole earth.
Right. So we believe that everyone should have this. Even if they're not well informed.
Isn't this really a Western ideal?
This is
the idea that everybody should have the right to choose.
Sri Aurobindo says it's a rational idea. Right. But for Sri Aurobindo, it's inevitable as a stage of development, east or west.
There's different regions on the planet may develop in different ways.
So he was writing in this at the time when his main purpose in life was to influence the Indian nation to become rational. And in this particular book, there is this fire of purpose in every chapter. He is trying to make it absolutely clear that this has to happen because it's the necessary in order for the next stage to happen, which he was also looking at squarely. Are we dead?
The point was interesting. If we don't keep in mind this development from more general structure to more individual structure, if you don't see that need in concretion of the spirit, which can happen only first through ego sense, which is thrown by vital already, as a necessity to come to that peak of possibilities of the spirit, not of nature, not of general welfare and harmony of living, but there has to be something more, some other quality has to come in, and comes in only through the individual formation. For that reason is necessary. And all these struggles and all these clashes are appearing very useful because there will be finally a will of individual. The supreme will become many finally. There will be many supreme individuals. So what kind of society will be then? We do not know, because that society which we know, that's why he writes this book, and A Rule of Human Unity starts with this, there is nothing more obscure to us than our collective life. Because that collective life starts somewhere on the previous stage. It's not yet developed into that to support those three individuals. It's just now in the process of development. And it's a very tricky thing, because as you remember his definition of life, it was that it comes from that social life, comes from the lower levels.
So if I press this, does it come back?
Oh, you.
I haven't pressed anything.
It comes back.
So it just hibernated. Okay. We're going to get to that stage that Vladimir was just addressing shortly. I'll go quickly through here now because it's 10:45. He can conceive a progressive order by which he shall be able to evolve and develop his capacities far beyond their original limits and workings. He can initiate an intelligent evolution which he himself shall determine, or at least be in it a conscious instrument, more a cooperating and constantly consulted party. The rest of terrestrial existence is helplessly enslaved and tyrannized over by its nature. But the instinct of man, when he finds his manhood, is to be master of his nature and free. At present, it is this which is at work. A self-conscious soul in mind, mental being, Manomaya Purusha, struggles to arrive at some intelligent ordering of itself and life, and some indefinite, perhaps infinite, development of the powers and potentialities of the human instrument. All action. Now try to conceive of something beyond yourself for a moment. Include in yourself all selves and nature and the environment, and just be aware of this life force that has been evolving for 3.5 billion years for a moment. All action, all perception, in the amoeba and in the shrew and in the human being, all aesthesis and sensation, all impulse and will, all imagination and creation imply a universal, many-sided force of knowledge at work. And each form or power of this knowledge has its own distinct nature and law, its own principle of order and arrangement, its logic proper to itself, and need not follow, still less be identical with, the law of nature, order, and arrangement which the intellectual reason would assign to it. Everything has its own rule, its own order, its own logic, its own sensation, its own perception, and its own power of being, which is not necessarily what the most highly evolved level, called the human reason, would expect it to do or be or have. But the intellect has this advantage over the others, that it can disengage itself from the work of its nature, stand back from it to study and understand it disinterestedly, analyze its processes, disengage its principles. Reason exists for the sake of knowledge, can prevent itself from being carried away by the action, can stand back from it, intelligently study, accept, refuse, modify, alter, improve, combine, and recombine the workings and capacities of the forces in operation, can repress here, indulge there, strive towards an intelligent, intelligible, willed and organized perfection. Reason is science. It is conscious art. It is invention. It is observation, and can seize and arrange truth of facts. It is speculation, and can extricate and forecast truth of potentiality. It is the idea and its fulfillment, the ideal and its bringing to fruition. It can look through the immediate appearance and unveil the hidden truths behind it. And that is time transcendence. This is the goal of the phenomenological being. It is the servant and yet the master of all utilities. It can, putting away all utilities, seek disinterestedly truth for its own sake, and by finding it, reveal a whole world of new possible utilities. In the other spheres of human consciousness and human activity, it may be thought that it has the right to the sovereign place, since these move on the lower plane of the rational and the finite, or belong to that borderland where the rational and the infrarational meet, and the impulses and the instincts of man stand in need above all of the right light and the control of the reason. In its own sphere of finite knowledge, science, philosophy, the useful arts, its right, one would think, must be indisputable. But this does not turn out, in the end, to be true. Its province may be larger, its powers more ample, its action more justly self-confident, but in the end, everywhere it finds itself standing between the two other powers of our being, and fulfilling in greater or less degree the same function of an intermediary. On one side, it is an enlightener, not always the chief enlightener, and the corrector of our life impulses and first mental seekings. On the other, it is only one minister of the veiled spirit and a preparer of the paths for the coming of its rule. This is especially evident in the two realms which in the ordinary scale of our powers stand nearest to the reason and on either side of it, the aesthetic and the ethical being. So here we have the triangle of the higher intelligence that has evolved in nature: the aesthetic, the ethical, and the rational. The search for beauty and the search for good, as well as the search for impartial knowledge, truth. These are the evolving powers of the mental being. Where the greatest and most powerful creation of beauty is accomplished, and its appreciation and enjoyment rise to the highest pitch, the rational is always surpassed and left behind. The creation of beauty in poetry and art does not fall within the sovereignty or even within the sphere of the reason. The intellect is not the poet, the artist, the creator within us. Creation comes by a supra-rational influx of light and power, which must work always, if it is to do its best, by vision and inspiration. It may use the intellect for certain of its operations, but in proportion as it subjects itself to the intellect, it loses in power and force of vision and diminishes the splendor and truth of the beauty it creates. Now, that's the end of the mental. There are a few slides here which deal with the psychic and spiritual and supramental level of development. And I'll read just one of them, I think. Maybe others, but this one is essential. The secret of the transformation lies in the transference of our center of living to a higher consciousness and in a change of our main power of living. This will be a leap or an ascent even more momentous than that which nature must at one time have made from the vital mind of the animal to the thinking mind still imperfect in our human intelligence. The central will implicit in life must be no longer the vital will in the life and the body, but the spiritual will, of which we have now only rare and dim intimations and glimpses. For now it comes to us hardly disclosed, weakened, disguised in the mental idea. But it is in its own nature supramental, and it is its supramental power and truth that we have somehow to discover. The main power of our living must be no longer the inferior vital urge of nature, which is already accomplished in us and can only whirl upon its rounds about the ego center, but that spiritual force of which we sometimes hear and speak, but have not yet its inmost secret. This means that man has developed a new power of being. Let us call it a new soul power, with the premise that we regard the life and the body also as a soul power. And the being who has done that is under an inherent obligation not only to look at the world and revalue all in it from this new elevation, but to compel his whole nature to obey this power and in a way reshape itself in its mold, and even to reshape, so far as he can, his environmental life into some image of this greater truth and law. Man's road to spiritual supermanhood will be open when he declares boldly that all he has yet developed, including the intellect of which he is so rightly and yet so vainly proud, are now no longer sufficient for him. And that to uncase, discover, set free this greater light within shall be henceforward his pervading preoccupation. Then will his philosophy, art, science, ethics, social existence, vital pursuits be no longer an exercise of mind and life done for themselves, carried in a circle, but a means for the discovery of a greater truth behind mind and life, and for the bringing of its power into our human existence. So what we can see is that Sri Aurobindo posits a vital physical evolution which becomes subject to a mental rational evolution. And at the height of that mental rational evolution, there is the aesthetic, ethical, intuitional mind. And at each of these three levels, there is an involved spiritual supramental force or will working through the will of each of those levels. And that those lower three then become one in relation to that fourth. So there begins to be, at the beginning, there are two.
At the beginning, there is this duality, and in the end, there is this duality, and what should emerge, I mean the structures, you know, we have the structures, the Getsarian structures, the predominantly vital physical and the predominantly mental vital and the predominantly rational mental and then the predominantly, hopefully, where we are here, and intuitional spiritual. And then ultimately, this supramental principle integrates all of these. But for a while now, it seems that we have this duality, which is working on an integration and synthesis. This is the emerging, this is the established world, the threefold complex, and this is the principle that is trying to emerge. And all along, this one has been the absolute of power, the absolute of beauty, the absolute of truth, the absolute of goodness, has been driving from the primal ever-present origin through the will of each of these levels. I think that's Sri Aurobindo's system.
Time for tea.
Thank you.